From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Turkish state media says the Saudi consul left Turkey today, and authorities are planning to search his residence in connection with missing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And there are reports from CNN and the New York Times that Saudi Arabia is getting ready to acknowledge that he died during a botched interrogation in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Khashoggi, whose criticism of Saudi policy appeared in the Washington Post, hasn't been seen since he entered that consulate 2 weeks ago. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met today with Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his father, King Salman, in Riyadh. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman is there. Michelle, what more do we know about Pompeo's meeting with the Saudi leaders?
Not much. You know, he's been very tight-lipped about this whole idea. You know, the Saudis seem to be changing their story, but U.S. officials traveling with Pompeo really don't want to say much until he has all of his meetings, and that includes a much longer dinner tonight with the Crown Prince, who's been kind of a key figure in all of this.
Well, when we spoke about this yesterday, we learned that the talk in the region is of this rogue killer that might have been in the consulate. That's what many Saudis are hearing. President Trump mentioned that after his conversation with the king yesterday. Are you hearing? I mean, what are you hearing people there say?
The Saudi media has been focused on one narrative, so it'll be interesting if they actually do switch the narrative completely around here, how people here react to the news. The U.S. government is, you know, wants to hear the whole story and hear it face to face rather than just on the phone and just through the media before they make any determination. I mean, they're not even telling us if they believe what they're hearing or whether anyone should believe what they're hearing from the Saudis on this.
Well, what about the reports from CNN and the New York Times that the Saudis are preparing what may ultimately be the truth, that this was a death that occurred during a botched interrogation, which, of course, that doesn't sound like an interrogation. It sounds like, you know, torture if someone dies during it. The prince is newly ascendant, you know, in his leadership role. There's reporting that it might have been an intelligence officer trying to impress him. What are you hearing in response to that reporting?
Well, you know, it's not only this, Robin, but, you know, there's been a lot of things happening in this country where you have women activists being jailed. Last year you had the Ritz-Carlton turn into a prison of, you know, four Saudi princes caught up in these corruption crackdowns. But it was so interesting watching Secretary Pompeo, because rather than coming in and really, you know, demanding answers or being firm, all you saw were smiles when he was there with the king, with the Saudi crown prince. They exchanged pleasantries. If you didn't know that this was a time of real tensions and a real issue hanging over this, it looked like any other visit that I've taken with the Secretary of State.
Well, that could be to try to smooth things over because it's such a delicate situation. And explain why that is. You know, the president keeps referring to an arms deal, which isn't really a deal. It's sort of a promise of purchase of weapons by the Saudis. But the Saudis are invested heavily elsewhere. I mean, why might the Trump administration be tiptoeing around this?
Well, Saudi Arabia is key to their regional goals and ambitions. Remember, this president came in talking tough about Iran. And, you know, you still hear Secretary Pompeo focusing on Iran almost nonstop and not criticizing the Saudis in that way at all. They pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. They're reimposing sanctions on Iran, including oil sanctions that go into effect in early November. And they want the Saudis to continue to keep the oil market stable. So, you know, for them, this is a terrible time for something like this to happen. As shocking as it is to the rest of the world, you know, they need Saudi Arabia for that, for the Iran deal. They need Saudi Arabia for the Middle East peace deal that Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has been working on. Saudi Arabia is a key to that as well. Mm. So, you know, this is a very delicate dance for Secretary Pompeo to be doing, because, you know, the president has already made it clear that he doesn't want to upend arms deals. He doesn't want to upend business relationships with the Saudis. But they do say they want somebody held accountable for this crime against, or, you know, alleged crime against Jamal Khashoggi, and they want to know what happened to him.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visits there. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
European Union leaders meet tomorrow to discuss Brexit, the UK's decision to leave the EU. Here's what it sounded like yesterday when Prime Minister Theresa May spoke to the House of Commons.
We are entering the final stages of these negotiations. This is the time.
They're laughing there. Joining us now, BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, they're chuckling. What's the sense today about the future of Brexit?
You want to know why they were laughing. And of course, it's not a great look for a prime minister to have the parliament laughing at you. They were laughing because they were thinking in the last stages of the negotiations, but sadly not the negotiations between the UK and the EU, but negotiations still going on between the British government itself. And in many ways, that's at the heart of the problem, Jeremy. It always has been, and it still is. That is that the governing Conservative Party just can't agree amongst itself what they want their future relationship with the European Union to be. So essentially what Theresa May appears to have done in her meeting with cabinet ministers is to just kind of kick the can down the road and keep the show on the road. But the problem is still there.
Well, and how long can she continue to kick the can down the road? Isn't there a deadline coming up next year?
There is. The deadline is March 29th, which is the date in which Britain will leave the European Union if nothing, absolutely nothing else happens. The chances of Britain leaving without a deal, I think, are going up. But, and you knew there was a but coming, because the consequences of Britain leaving the European Union without a deal are so bad, not just for the UK, but not great for the EU either, both sides are anxious to try and strike a deal. So, you know, will the talks go all the way up to the 29th? I mean, clearly, I don't know that. I mean, for goodness sake, the Prime Minister doesn't know that. But I think they will continue to talk. Now, will they get a deal? Well, as I say, I think that's just looking more and more difficult by the minute.
It seems like right now the big focus is on what happens at the Irish border with the Brexit, that the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland right now, it's not a hard border, but there's thought that it would be a hard border if there's a hard Brexit, I guess.
Yeah, do you know, explaining this one, it's a bit like, you know, the famous Oscar Wilde quote where he described English gentlemen as fox hunting as being the unspeakable in pursuit of the uneatable. trying to explain this part of Brexit is a bit like, you know, trying to explain the inexplicable. So I'll do my very best. So here's the deal. You know, there was a peace agreement in Northern Ireland in 1998, and a key part of that, making that a success, was the open border. Both the European Union and the UK are agreed that when Britain leaves the EU, it's going to be really important not to put a physical border back there, which could be a target for attacks. Now, the hope is that you would achieve that through some post-Brexit great free trade agreement between the UK and the European Union. But basically what's been happening is the EU and the UK has agreed to this, said, look, we're going to have a backstop, an insurance policy to make sure that even if we can't get that free trade agreement, there's something in place. And that has proved massively controversial. And you could forgive everybody on the Remain side of the argument during the referendum from screaming at the top of their voices, we told you so, everyone, that Brexit could be a threat to the peace process in Northern Ireland, indeed to the very unity of the United Kingdom.
So there's this meeting tomorrow, Rob, in Brussels. EU leaders are going to be meeting there. What do you expect will happen?
I expect they'll be incredibly polite and incredibly sympathetic. But when Theresa May says, please, 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 can you give me some help here? I think they'll just say no. The way the European Union sees it is that Britain has decided to give up its membership of the gym club, right? And they're saying, look, if you do that, we really wish you would stay members of the gym. We liked it when you were here. It was great to see you working out with us. But you can't expect to leave the club and still have all the same rights of membership, you know, use all the equipment. And the Europeans feel that somehow that message just hasn't come home, that the British politicians are just refusing to accept it, that there will be a cost to leaving the European Union, that you won't have the same frictionless trade, and that it's really up to British politicians to explain that to the British people, not for them to change their rules.
Rob, I was thinking about the fact that when you close a web browser these days, it asks you, are you sure you want to do that? And I wondered, I mean, is there any chance that there's going to be another referendum that they'll say, are you sure that you want a Brexit?
Let me just dust off my crystal ball there for a second there, Jeremy. So look, of the three kind of options, I think the most likely remains some kind of a deal, just because the consequences of there not being one would be so terrible. But I think it's also increasingly possible that Britain could just crash out without a deal, bad as that would be. Or third, that there would be some absolute domestic political crisis, in which case, yeah, maybe there would be another referendum. Now then, if you were to ask the question, would people definitely vote to remain, I'd have to say, contact me later when the referendum is scheduled.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, in London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be broadcasting from London next month with a focus on Brexit. Stay tuned, Here and Now.
There are an estimated 200,000 Salvadorans living in the U.S. with temporary protected status, or TPS. Earlier this year, the Trump administration announced the end of the program for Salvadorans. But earlier this month, a federal judge in California blocked that decision. So while their fate plays out in court, Salvadorans living here with temporary status can stay, for now, without fear of deportation. But WBUR's Shannon Dooling was recently in El Salvador and brings us the story of how families and communities there and in Massachusetts are bracing for what could be the end of TPS.
Isabel Quintanilla is FaceTiming with her daughter, Irma Flores. This is the easiest way for the two to keep in touch. Quintanilla asks how her new great-grandson is sleeping. Quintanilla hasn't met her great-grandson. She lives in El Salvador. Flores lives in Haverhill, a city north of Boston. Flores has lived in Massachusetts for almost 20 years with TPS. The temporary immigration status allows people from countries devastated by natural disasters or civil war to stay in the U.S. without fear of deportation. And since 2001, when El Salvador was hit by back-to-back earthquakes, TPS for that country has been regularly renewed until earlier this year, when the Trump administration announced the end of the program. Flores says it's hard to comprehend the thought of returning to El Salvador.
It's difficult. I never had the time to ask about my own family. I just need that time to figure it out. Okay, we have to make some decisions.
Decisions like, does she leave behind her daughter, her son, and her grandchildren? Does she leave behind her career working with the city of Somerville? An estimated 7,000 Salvadorans living in New England with TPS are facing similar decisions.
Doesn't matter what are the reasons you came to this country, but I think we have been demonstrating to the government we are hard workers.
People with TPS are authorized to work in the U.S. The Center for American Progress estimates Salvadoran TPS holders pump more than $400 million into Massachusetts' GDP annually. Because many of the recipients, like Flores, have been living here for so long, they've started families, they own businesses, and they've bought homes. And they're not only pumping money into communities here, but also into communities back in their home country of El Salvador.
What began essentially as an act of love and support over time became the most important source of foreign revenue for El Salvador.
That's Oscar Chacon, executive director of Alianza Americas, an umbrella group of immigrant advocates. He says remittances, money sent by Salvadorans living abroad, primarily in the U.S., replaced revenue from exports of sugarcane, coffee, and cotton. These cash crops took a big hit during El Salvador's civil war in the 80s and early 90s. The Salvadoran Central Bank now estimates that close to 16% of the country's gross national income comes from remittances. Just over $5 million were sent back to El Salvador from the U.S. last year. That's up nearly 10% from the year before. So why the increase? Chacon points to the end of TPS.
Because people in the U.S. are fearful that their days when they were able to keep sending money may be coming to an end.
People in El Salvador also fear the end of TPS. San Vicente is a small city about an hour's drive east of San Salvador. That's where Irma Flores' mother, Isabel Quintanilla, owns a bakery. The day we visit, the afternoon humidity mixes with the aroma of fresh-baked bread floating in the air. Quintanilla is wearing a red and white checkered apron, slicing pieces of homemade pastel de leche and semita de dulce. She stands behind steel bars while she works. Taking off her apron, Quintanilla sits down and explains why she hopes her daughter, Flores, never moves back here.
Nuestra situación acá en nuestro país no está bien.
Our situation here in our country isn't good. There's a lot of crime, there's extortion. Here, close to the center of San Vicente, is a little calmer, but a little ways up there, people are killed daily. All of the businesses, almost the majority, are extorted.
At one point, Quintanilla says she was doling out $2,500 in one day, $5,000 another day. She says young men were collecting the money for a local gang. They'd come in, demand the payment, and threaten to kill her if she didn't pay. Quintanilla had dreams of growing her business and recently tried opening a second location. But she says that sort of thing isn't a possibility here.
The result was that on two occasions, they assaulted me. They tied me up. They pressed their guns against me. They took everything of value, money, clothing, everything. So I had to close. Because the idea was to get ahead with the business, but with the situation the way it is here, no.
It's this sort of violence that concerns Quintanilla most when she thinks about her daughter returning to El Salvador. She says gangs can tell when someone who's been living in the U.S. is back in town. The way they look, their clothing, their accent. Quintanilla is afraid her daughter would be an easy target. But gang violence was not part of the calculation for the Trump administration when it terminated the program. Instead, senior administration officials said they focused only on country conditions related to the earthquakes that led to El Salvador's TPS. But that's a much more narrow reading of the TPS legislation than what's been used by past administrations.
Immigration laws that Congress has enacted are some of the most generous in the world.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has echoed this sentiment on multiple occasions. Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern disagrees with this interpretation of temporary protected status. McGovern, who recently visited El Salvador, says the emphasis was always meant to be placed on protected, not temporary.
I've had conversations with the Secretary of Homeland Security, who didn't seem to understand what TPS was. I do because I helped write the bill when I was working for Congressman Joe Moakley. But the bottom line is that after all this time, these people deserve our understanding and they deserve our compassion.
Back at the bakery in San Vicente, Quintanilla and Flores are still talking about work and grandchildren. Quintanilla says she hopes her daughter will be able to fix her status to stay in Massachusetts. Until then, Flores says she'll keep sending back a little money to her mom every month. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Last week's report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change quickly dropped out of the headlines. It called for, among other things, reducing our investments in fossil fuels by about a quarter. Oil companies have been hesitant to take that kind of action. So our next guest is trying to pressure them by purchasing their stock. Mark Van Baal is founder of Follow This, a Dutch shareholder activist group that has been buying shares in Shell. Mark, how many does your group own and what do you do with those shares?
We own around 20 million euros worth in shares with 4,000 shareholders. And what we do with it, we organize support for Shell to commit to the Paris Climate Agreement.
But they haven't agreed to do that yet.
No, they are hesitating, and that's why they need shareholders to support them.
So do you think that you're having an impact?
Yeah, we have an impact. We file shareholder resolutions in which we ask shareholders to support Shell to set targets that are aligned with Paris. And they rejected our Shell resolution, but 6% of the voting investors, and among them 6 of the 10 biggest Dutch pension funds, voted for our resolution. Hmm. And Shell had to respond to that, and I did that with a, let's call it a climate ambition, They were the first oil and gas company to do so. So with Shell, we showed that a 6% vote is attainable and apparently enough for a company to respond.
So do you think that this is a better use of your money than using that same money to support an environmental group or something like that?
I think we should do everything to stop climate change. Our children are going to ask us, you know the problem, you know the solution, you knew the solution, what did you do about it? All efforts work, and this is the effort I choose. But I think what the NGOs are doing is making visible that the oil industry is nowhere near helping to make the Paris Climate Agreement a success is also important.
Can they actually ever be a part of the solution, or would it be best for your interest if they just go out of business?
They have to be part of the solution. The oil industry is really the only party who can make or break the Paris Climate Agreement. So we need them. We need them to change.
There was a study from a researcher at Harvard funded by the National Association of Manufacturers that found that shareholder-based resolutions about climate change have no statistically significant impact on a company's bottom line. What do you think about that?
Now, we've proven in the Netherlands that we have a huge impact. We are Shell's most influential shareholder. We force them to set the climate ambition. So this is changing. And in the past, climate resolutions were more about a moral appeal. We have, of course, a moral cause, but we have very financial arguments. That's the reason this is now successful. Pension funds, big investors, they are aware that if climate change is not limited, there are a lot of financial risks that need to be stopped.
That's Mark van Baal, who is a founder of a Dutch shareholder activist group trying to push oil companies to take action against climate change. Thank you so much.
Great to be there, Jeremy. Thanks.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A new report from NPR and the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University finds that women in prisons across the country are punished more often and more severely than men. NPR's Joseph Shapiro worked on this story with reporter Jessica Popovac. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And give us an example of what you're talking about here, how women inmates are punished more harshly than men.
They get punished for the more minor violations of prison rules, for nonviolent offenses. In California, we met a woman named Victoria Williams who talked well about just how ridiculous some of these punishments were.
Petty stuff. You can get written up for not closing your doors, or if you just want to just fix your room up nice and just take some Kool-Aid and dye your pillowcase, you get written up for that.
They get punished particularly for offenses where there's a lot of gray area, where a corrections officer gets to say if it's an offense or not. And in Illinois, women were 5 times more likely than men to be cited for this offense called minor insolence. 2 women we met in Illinois said years ago they were cited for something that was called reckless eyeballing.
And what are the consequences of different punishments or more harsh punishments for women inmates?
There's serious consequences. You can lose good conduct credits. That's time that's taken off your stay in prison. In Illinois, we found in 1 year alone, 2015, some women lost months, even years of those credits. By the way, Illinois has now fixed that problem. But we found disproportionate loss of good conduct credits in California, Louisiana, and other states. In other states, women get punished for small things and go to solitary confinement. Hmm. But one of the most common consequences is that women lose visitation and phone privileges, and that's cutting off mothers from their children.
And why is this happening?
Oh, it's because prisons were built to control men, often violent men. And then we applied these rules that were created for men, we apply them to women.
Do the prisons recognize that this is a problem?
Some do. Tonight, we're going to do a story about something called gender-responsive corrections. It's the idea of looking at why women are different. The fact that they are less likely to come for violent crimes, and once they're in prison, they're less likely to be violent. And then also they come with this high level of past trauma. Some 75 to 90% have this history of physical and sexual abuse. And that affects how they respond in prison. If a corrections officer is yelling at them, that might trigger some past trauma. So at this prison that we're going to visit tonight in Iowa, they've changed the way they do things, like strip searches. A woman can now take off one piece of clothing at a time and then put it back on. And the idea is to make something that can be traumatic, a strip search, a little less traumatic.
Joe, how difficult is it to do this kind of reporting inside the prison system in this country?
It's very hard to get inside a prison. Prisons are some of the most closed-off places in this country. And we got invited into some prisons only when they were willing to show us what they were doing, only when they thought they were making some change. But we were not allowed generally to talk to prisoners. So we had to do other things. We had to write letters to prisoners. We had to find women who'd been in prison and had been released. We did Freedom of Information Act requests, and we were able to get this glimpse of how this unequal system of punishment comes down most harshly on women.
And we'll get a glimpse of it later today on All Things Considered, the next part of your investigation. NPR's Joseph Shapiro, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
A year ago today, Maltese investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia was killed by a car bomb. Her murder is unsolved, her work also unfinished until now. For the past 6 months, journalists around the world have been working to finish the investigations Daphne started, thanks to the nonprofit Forbidden Stories, which continues the work of murdered journalists. And last week, five members of the European Parliament called for the European Commission to back an investigation into Galizia's murder, citing revelations from the Forbidden Stories work, including that the Maltese government sale of Maltese passports to wealthy Russians for 1 million euros was enabling those Russians to enter European Union countries and carry out money laundering and other crimes. Laurent Richard is founder and executive director of Forbidden Stories. Laurent, you and other reporters picked up quite a few of the threads that Daphne Caruana Galizia was pulling on. Tell us more.
Well, we were, thanks to the work of 45 reporters for the past 6 months, we were able to reveal some information regarding the high level of corruption inside the Maltese highland. And we were revealing some concerning facts about some potential links between the economy minister and some of the people who have been arrested because they were triggering the bomb. They were literally pushing the button.
Wait, pushing the button?
Yeah, they were using the cell phone that was connected to the bomb under the car of Daphne Caruana Galizia on the day she have been killed. At least they are suspected of doing that, and they were arrested. And so during that investigation with the work of that collaborative team, we were able to meet some people who told us that they have seen the economy minister with those two suspects before the murder. And the work of the Daphne Project was not only about to identify who might be the killers, but also to complete the stories of Daphne and to complete a very critical work, because her stories was about sensitive issues like corruption, organized crime. So that's why we decided to complete the work of Daphne, and the name of that project was the Daphne Project.
So again, you know, the Maltese government, she was doing an investigation into possible corruption having to do with matters of the economy. And here you have, you found the economic minister connecting with some of the suspects in her death. That's quite something. Look, I just want to back up and talk about how all this started, because it's an incredibly compelling story. You worked in a news agency across the hall from the Charlie Hebdo office. Tell us about your experience there.
Well, I'm investigative reporter for the past 20 years, and I used to travel a lot and to do some reporting in some countries where there is no freedom of press. But another thing convinced me more personally, a personal event in my life convinced me to start Forbidden Stories. And this happened actually in 2015, when two terrorists of Al-Qaeda in Yemen arrived in the street where the offices of the company where I was working for was in Paris. and they entered the building and they killed the Charlie Hebdo newsroom. Yeah. And we were sharing the same floor. They were the door right next to hers. And this day, I just arrived 2 minutes after the terrorist escaped the building. Mm. And I entered the newsroom and then I was the first to discover my friends and colleagues of Charlie Hebdo just dying or just already dead. Mm. And we did our best to help the people who were survivors. And so this literally changed my life because this was happening in Paris. This was not happening on a conflict zone. It was not in Iraq. It was in the middle of Paris. It was in my personal environment. It was about colleagues I know and who were doing exactly the same work as me, the same job. They were journalists and they were killed for a story they were able to publish. And so it was really a traumatic experience. And it took a lot of time to recover, of course, for that and trying to forget some very difficult pictures. But on that day, I decided what I can do as a journalist to continue the work of murdered reporters, to keep stories alive. And usually when a journalist is dying for one story, that probably means that the story is very relevant to the public opinion. It's very important to continue and to keep these stories alive.
Yeah, you said something so compelling there. Usually when a journalist gets killed, they're onto something. And so for you, it's about figuring out what that was. And as you say, sending a message out to the murderers, you can kill the messenger, but you won't kill the message, the story. Look, this has been going on for a while. When Arizona reporter Don Bowles was killed in 1976, a new organization sprung up. It was called the Investigative Reporters and Editors, and they set out to finish his work. But there have been over 60 journalists killed this year, many of their deaths connected to their work. We also here in the United States, in Annapolis, a newspaper was attacked, so many killed. Threats were made against the Boston Globe by a California man. He threatened to kill all of them. Do you despair? I mean, it doesn't feel as if, you know, the message is getting out.
Yeah, well, we are really facing a lot of threats, not only in South America, not only in Mexico, in Europe too, in all continents. And I think that the only response, which is very efficient, it's a global and collaborative response. Collaboration brings protection. If you are working together, if the killer will see that there is a group of journalists ready to complete the investigation and to expose their crimes, then they will probably think twice the next time they will think about killing one reporter. You were talking about the Arizona Project. That's a great and very inspiring project. And I do think that we have to react this way. We have to send this powerful signal to the enemies of the press. You kill the messenger, you will never kill the message, because we are here to make sure people get access to these very important stories. So, yes, there is a lot of work. We need some support. There are a lot of journalists who have been killed. There are a lot of many forbidden stories behind that we need to publish. It's quite urgent to do that. Mm. And a journalist who is dying is not just a number. We're talking about important stories, important information that some people wanted to hide, some people wanted to silence.
Well, and there are other groups. I mentioned Investigative Reporters and Editors. There's also the group Organized Crime Corruption Reporting Project that pursued another investigation in 2015 when an investigative journalist was locked up in Azerbaijan. There's a Brazilian nonprofit organization, I think it's Abraji, A-B-R-A-J-I.
Yes.
They continued the work of another reporter. So this has been going on, this, as you said, collaborative, so that it's the investigative work is spread out among many reporters. That brings us to the Saudi journalist who wrote for, among other papers, The Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi. U.S. and Turkish officials believe that he was murdered inside the Saudi consulate in Turkey. Have you been already eyeing his work?
Well, of course, this is the kind of case that we should be interested in what the story is he was publishing, he was working on. We need to know more about the Saudi regime, and we need to expose that. So that's I hope we will get more information about the disappearance of this journalist, and I hope that we'll be able to get some information. Saudi Arabia is a very difficult country to work in. So he was a kind of voice, very rare, very unique. So we need that kind of journalism, and so we need to work together and to look at what kind of stories he was publishing those past years.
And one last thought. I'm wondering, you said when you came upon your colleagues, largely the cartoonists, satirical cartoonists from Charlie Hebdo who'd been murdered or were dying, you said that you said you could not get those images out of your head.
Yeah.
Has the work that you're doing, though, has that eased that at all?
That's a very good question. I'm not doing that for being able to forget those kind of different kind of pictures. But it's really helpful because I think that I wanted to do something as a journalist. And so by doing that, I think I can bring on the table my skills as an investigative reporter to defend press freedom. And I do think that journalism can defend journalism, and that's probably the most efficient way to make sure people get access to this information. So, yeah, for me it's very important to continue the work and to convince other partners to be on board on the new project we're starting.
Lauren, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Juliette.
That's Lauren Richard, founder and executive director of Forbidden Stories, the organization that exists on donations and continues the work left behind by murdered journalists.
What do you think of when you hear TGI Fridays? Family restaurant, suburbia, potato skins? Well, it turns out TGI Fridays played an important role in the sexual revolution. It started on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and helped change the way many Americans meet, date, and get married. Dan Bobkoff hosts Business Insider's Household Name, a podcast about how famous brands affect life and culture. Here's his story of TGI Fridays' wild early days.
In 1968, Ellen Lattman was 22 and living at home with her parents on Long Island.
I was not what my father called a loose girl to go into the city and go to bars.
But one night, her friends insisted that Ellen come with them to a new spot on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It's not like other bars, they said. She walks in, and the place is packed. Young people are standing 3-4 deep from the bar. And then a big, tall guy walks over to Ellen and asks if she wants to go to a show.
So I said, why? I said, are you asking me out on a date? And he said, no. He said, you see that guy over there sitting in the corner? He needs a date. He had a date with a girl. She broke the date tonight, and he still has the tickets. So I said, well, what's wrong with him? Why doesn't he come over and ask me?
That guy in the corner is Stan. Ellen looks over, and Stan is cute, but he's not her type. Too drunk, for one thing.
His friend says to him, this is the girl we've picked out for you. And he said to me, I can do better. And I said, really? Well, then go right ahead. I said, I had no interest in you anyway.
And you said that to your face?
Yeah. So between you and me, I said, F you, and walked away.
The place where all this happened? TGI Fridays. For years after it opened in 1965, TGI Fridays was the place to be young and single in New York. All thanks to a then 28-year-old, Alan Stillman.
Well, was out looking for girls.
How was that going before Fridays?
Fair. Not fair. Bad, but certainly at the time there was nothing like that for people in their 20s just getting out of college. There was no place really for them to hang out.
Alan didn't set out to change how Americans date. There wasn't some grand plan. It just happened to be the sexual revolution when he spotted a business opportunity.
My business plan was to meet a lot of women. It's a hell of a business plan, I'll tell you that. The word singles ball was not invented, and I certainly didn't think that I was inventing anything like that whatsoever.
Alan bought a tired old bar with a bullet hole in the window and set about making a place where women would feel comfortable going alone, where men could try out pickup lines for the first time. He threw some sawdust on the floor and hung some Tiffany lamps above the tables. College kids were saying, thank God it's Friday, so that's what he called it. When it opened, it was like the city's pent-up desire was unleashed.
It was so crowded and so that you didn't have to walk up to anybody to get a name or to get a telephone number. You bumped into them.
Imitators sprung up almost immediately on the block. Cops had to close the street to traffic on the weekend. New York Magazine dubbed the area the Fertile Crescent. After a few years, Allen lent the name to a franchise in Memphis. Then came locations in Dallas, Indianapolis, and Little Rock. In each city where TGI Fridays was coming, crowds of young people waited anxiously for this hot new singles bar. Through the 70s, few places were as cool as a TGI Fridays, which may be hard to believe today.
It's become more of a family operation, and the people that it competes with are also family restaurants.
Allen is in his 80s now. He hasn't been involved with TGI Fridays in decades. Why do you think it lost its singles origin and became more of a family restaurant?
You don't need a TGI Fridays bar scene to meet somebody, either male-female or female-male, or for that matter, anybody to meet anybody. We're back to all the electronics that are around here. So it's just not a necessity, whereas at the time, although I didn't know it, we invented a necessity and we solved a problem that was really a big problem.
It turned out it solved a problem for Ellen Lattman. That charmer Stan, who she didn't have much patience for that first night at Fridays, well, he managed to get her number via his wingman.
And Stan called me the next day and said, "I'm so sorry." He said, "I must have insulted you. I don't remember what I said, but I really do have these tickets and I really would like to take you out."
And then he took her to a show.
I think it was Carousel.
The date went a lot better than when they met at Fridays.
3 months later, we were engaged, and 9 months later, we were married.
So is the lesson here to insult someone on the first date?
He's never lived that down. But as I said, he didn't really remember it, and he's really a nice, quiet, lovely guy. But he was inebriated. We're coming on 50 years, so it worked.
50 years. And it's all because of Fridays.
And it's all because of Fridays. Absolutely.
For Here and Now, I'm Dan Bobkoff.
Dan Bobkoff hosts Household Name, a podcast from Business Insider that tells the stories of some well-known brands, surprising stories about those well-known brands. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to change my thought about Fridays from potato skins to matchmaker.
I hadn't thought of it at all, actually.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.